Part 1. Spies and Diplomats. Two Puzzles. Chapter 1. Fidel Castro's Revenge. Florentino Aspiaga's final posting was in Bratislava, in what was then Czechoslovakia. It was 1987, 2 years before the Iron Curtain fell. Aspiaga ran a consulting company called Cuba Technica, which was supposed to have something to do with trade. It did not. It was a front. Aspiaga was a high-ranking officer in Cuba's General Directorate of Intelligence. Aspiaga had been named Intelligence Officer of the Year in the Cuban Spy Service in 1985. He had been given a handwritten letter of commendation from Fidel Castro himself. He had served his country with distinction in Moscow, Angola, and Nicaragua. He was a star. In Bratislava, he ran Cuba's entire network of agents in the region. But at some point during his steady ascent through the Cuban intelligence service, he grew disenchanted. He watched Castro give a speech in Angola celebrating the communist revolution there and had been appalled by the Cuban leader's arrogance and narcissism. By the time of his posting to Bratislava in 1986, those doubts had hardened. He planned his defection for June 6, 1987. It was an elaborate inside joke. June 6 was the anniversary of the founding of the Cuban Ministry of the Interior, the all-powerful body that administered the country's spy services. If you worked for the General Directorate of Intelligence, you would ordinarily celebrate on June 6. There would be speeches, receptions, ceremonies in honor of Cuba's espionage apparatus. Aspiaga wanted his betrayal to sting. He met up with his girlfriend Marta in a park in downtown Bratislava. It was Saturday afternoon. She was Cuban as well, one of thousands of Cubans who were guest workers in Czech factories. Like all Cubans in her position, her passport was held at the Cuban government offices in Prague. Aspiaga would have to smuggle her across the border. He had a government-issued Mazda. He removed the spare tire from the trunk, drilled an air hole in the floor, and told her to climb inside. Eastern Europe at that point was still walled off from the rest of the continent. Travel between East and West was heavily restricted, but Bratislava was only a short drive from Vienna, and Aspiaga had made the trip before. He was well known at the border and carried a diplomatic passport. The guards waved him through. In Vienna, he and Marta abandoned the Mazda, hailed a taxi, and presented themselves at the gates to the United States Embassy. It was Saturday evening. The senior staff was all at home, but Aspiaga did not need to do much to get the guard's attention. "I am a case officer from Cuban intelligence. I am an intelligence commandante." In the spy trade, Aspiaga's appearance at the Vienna embassy is known as a walk-in. An official from the intelligence service of one country shows up unexpectedly on the doorstep of the intelligence service of another country. And Florentino Tiny Aspiaga was one of the great walk-ins of the Cold War. What he knew of Cuba and its close ally, the Soviet Union, was so sensitive that twice after his defection, his former employers at the Cuban spy service tracked him down and tried to assassinate him. Twice, he slipped away. Only once since has Aspiaga been spotted. It was by Brian Littell, who ran the CIA's Latin American office for many years. Littell got a tip from an undercover agent who was acting as Aspiaga's go-between. He met the go-between at a restaurant in Coral Gables, just outside Miami. There, he was given instructions to meet in another location, closer to where Aspiaga was living under his new identity. Littell rented a suite in a hotel, somewhere anonymous, and waited for Tiny to arrive.
He's younger than me. I'm 75. By now, probably in his upper 60s.
This is Littell remembering that meeting.
He's had terrible health problems. Terrible health problems. I mean, being a defector, living with a new identity, divorced, it's tough. It's tough.
Even in his diminished state, though, it was obvious what Aspiaga must have been like as a younger man, Littell says. Charismatic, slender, with a certain theatricality about him, a taste for risks and grand emotional gestures. When he came into the hotel suite, Aspiaga was carrying a box. He put it down on the table and turned to Littell.
This is a memoir that I wrote soon after I defected. He said, I want you to have this. He knew my interest in writing a book. Mm-hmm. So maybe part of his motive, maybe his main motive was that he wanted to be in my book.
Inside the box, in the pages of Aspiaga's memoir, was a story that made no sense. After his dramatic appearance at the American Embassy in Vienna, Aspiaga was flown to a debriefing center at a U.S. Army base in Germany. In those years, American intelligence operated out of the United States Interest Section in Havana under the Swiss flag. The Cuban delegation had a similar arrangement in the United States. Before his debriefing began, Aspiaga said he had one request. He wanted the CIA to fly in one of the former Havana station chiefs, a man known to Cuban intelligence as El Alpinista, the mountain climber. The mountain climber had served the agency all over the world. After the Berlin Wall fell, files retrieved from the KGB and the East German secret police revealed that they had taught a course on the mountain climber to their agents. His tradecraft was impeccable. Once Soviet intelligence officers tried to recruit him, they literally placed bags of money in front of him. He waved them off, mocked them. The mountain climber was incorruptible. He spoke Spanish like a Cuban. He was Aspiaga's role model. Aspiaga wanted to meet him face to face. I was on an assignment in another country when I got the message to rush to Frankfurt, the mountain climber remembers. Though long retired from the CIA, he still prefers to be identified only by his nickname. Frankfurt is where we had our defector processing center. They told me a fellow had walked into an embassy in Vienna. He had driven out of Czechoslovakia with his girlfriend in the trunk of his car, walked in, and insisted on speaking to me. I thought it was kind of crazy. El Alpinista went straight to the debriefing center. I found four case officers sitting in the living room, he remembers. They told me Aspiaga was back in the bedroom making love with his girlfriend, as he had constantly since he arrived at the safe house. Then I went in and spoke to him. He was lanky, poorly dressed, as Eastern Europeans and Cubans tended to be back then, a little sloppy. But it was immediately evident that he was a very smart guy. When he walked in, the mountain climber didn't tell Aspiaga who he was. He was trying to be cagey. Aspiaga was an unknown quantity. But it was only a matter of minutes before Aspiaga figured it out. There was a moment of shock, laughter. The two men hugged, Cuban style. We talked for 5 minutes before we started into the details. Whenever you're debriefing one of those guys, you need someone that proves their bona fides, the mountain climber said. So I just basically asked him what he could tell me about the Cuban intelligence operation. It was then that Aspiaga revealed his bombshell, the news that had brought him from behind the Iron Curtain to the gates of the Vienna embassy. The CIA had a network of spies inside Cuba whose dutiful reports to their case officers helped shape America's understanding of its adversary. Aspiaga named one of them and said, "He's a double agent. He works for us." The room was stunned. They had no idea. But Aspiaga kept going. He named another spy. "He's a double too." Then another. And another. He had names, details, chapter and verse. "That guy you recruited on the ship in Antwerp, the little fat guy with the mustache, he's a double. That other guy with a limp who works in the defense ministry, he's a double." He continued on like that until he had listed dozens of names, practically the entire U.S. roster of secret agents inside Cuba. They were all working for Havana, spoon-feeding the CIA information cooked up by the Cubans themselves. "I sat there and took notes," the mountain climber said. "I tried not to betray any emotion. That's what we're taught. But my heart was racing." Aspiaga was talking about the mountain climber's people, the spies he'd worked with when he'd been posted to Cuba as a young and ambitious intelligence officer. When he'd first arrived in Havana, the mountain climber had made a point of working his sources aggressively, mining them for information. "The thing is," the mountain climber said, "if you have an agent who's in the office of a president of whatever country, but you can't communicate with him, that agent is worthless. My feeling was, let's communicate and get some value rather than waiting 6 months or a year until he puts up someplace else. But now, the whole exercise turned out to have been a sham. I must admit that I disliked Cuba so much that I derived much pleasure from pulling the wool over their eyes, the mountain climber said, a little ruefully. But it turns out that I wasn't the one pulling the wool over their eyes. That was a bit of a blow. The mountain climber got on a military plane and flew with Aspiaga directly to Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, D.C., where they were met by bigwigs from the Latin American division. In the Cuba section, the reaction was absolute shock and horror, he remembers. They simply could not believe that they had been had so badly for so many years. It sent shockwaves. It got worse. When Fidel Castro heard that Aspiaga had informed the CIA of their humiliation, he decided to rub salt in the wound. First, he rounded up the entire cast to pretend CIA agents and paraded them across Cuba on a triumphant tour. Then he released on Cuban television an astonishing 11-part documentary entitled The Guerra de la CIA contra Cuba, the CIA's War Against Cuba.
En Estados Unidos, todo el mundo conoce lo que sucedió en Bahía de Cochinos, pero aproximadamente 10 o 15 años después de ese acontecimiento y hasta hoy, ha habido una intensificación de las acciones terroristas contra el gobierno de Cuba.
Cuban intelligence, it turned out, had filmed and recorded everything the CIA had been doing in their country for at least 10 years, as if they were creating a reality show, Survivor, Havana Edition. The video was surprisingly high quality. There were close-up shots and shots from cinematic angles. The audio was crystal clear. The Cubans must have had advanced word of every secret meeting place and sent their technicians over to wire the rooms for sound. On the screen, identified by name, were CIA officers supposedly under deep cover. There was video of every advanced CIA gadget, transmitters hidden in picnic baskets and briefcases. There were detailed explanations of which park bench CIA officers used to communicate with their sources and how the CIA used different colored shirts to secretly signal their contacts. A long tracking shot showed a CIA officer stuffing cash and instructions inside a large plastic rock. Another captured a CIA officer stashing secret documents for his agents inside a wrecked car in a junkyard in Pinar del Rio. In a third, a CIA officer looked for a package in long grass by the side of the road while his wife fumed impatiently in the car. The mountain climber made a brief cameo in the documentary. His successor fared far worse. When they showed that TV series, the mountain climber said, it looked as though they had a guy with a camera over his shoulder everywhere he went. When the head of the FBI's office in Miami heard about the documentary, he called up a Cuban official and asked for a copy. A set of videotapes was sent over promptly, thoughtfully dubbed in English. The most sophisticated intelligence service in the world had been played for a fool.
Langley, Virginia, Estados Unidos. Sede de la CIA. Un confortable edificio para promover el terrorismo en el mundo.
This is what makes no sense about Florentino Aspiaga's story. It would be one thing if Cuba had deceived a group of elderly shut-ins the way scam artists do. But the Cubans fooled the CIA, an organization that takes the task of understanding strangers very seriously. There were extensive files on every one of those double agents. The mountain climber says he checked them carefully, and there were no obvious red flags. Like all intelligence agencies, the CIA has a division, counterintelligence, whose job it is to monitor its own operations for signs of betrayal. What had they found? Nothing. Looking back on the episode years later, all Littell could do was shrug and say that the Cubans must have been really good.
They did it exquisitely. They were exquisitely skilled. I mean, Fidel selected the doubles that he dangled. He selected them with real brilliance. Some of them were trained in theatrical deception. One of them posed as a naif, that he was very naive and was really a very cunning, trained intelligence officer. Well, he's so goofy, how can he be a double? And Fidel orchestrated all of this. I mean, Fidel is the greatest actor of them all.
The mountain climber, for his part, argues that the trade craft of the CIA's Cuba section was just sloppy. He had previously worked in Eastern Europe up against the East Germans, and there, he said, the CIA had been much more meticulous. The CIA makes a regular practice of giving its agents lie detector tests to guard against just the kind of treachery that Aspiaga was describing. Whenever one of the agency's Cuban spies left the island, the CIA would meet them secretly in a hotel room and have them sit for a polygraph. Sometimes the Cubans would pass. The head of the polygraph division personally gave a clean bill of health to 6 Cuban agents who ended up being doubles. Other times, the Cubans would fail. But what happened when they did? The people running the Cuba section dismissed it. One of the CIA's former polygraphers, John Sullivan, remembers being summoned to a meeting after his group gave the thumbs down on a few too many Cuban assets.
And they ambushed us. We were berated unmercifully.
This is Sullivan.
All these case officers were saying, just you guys just don't know what you're doing. You know, Mother Teresa couldn't press you. I mean, they were really very, very nasty about it. You guys, you know, maybe once in a while there's one, but they all can be bad.
But can you blame them? The case officers chose to replace one method of making sense of strangers, strapping them to a polygraph machine, with another, their own judgment. And that's perfectly logical. Polygraphy is, to say the least, an inexact art. The case officer would have had years of experience with the agent, met them, talked to them, analyzed the quality of the reports they filed. The assessment of a trained professional made over the course of many years ought to be more accurate than the results of a hurried meeting in a hotel room, right? Except that it wasn't.
There are many of our case officers that think, you know, I'm such a good case officer, they can't fool me. This one guy I'm thinking of in particular, and he was a very, very good case officer.
Sullivan was clearly talking about the mountain climber.
They took him to the cleaners. They actually got him on film servicing a dendrop. And I mean, it was crazy.
But what was the CIA's record in East Germany? Just as bad as the CIA's record in Cuba. After the Berlin Wall fell, East German spy chief Marcus Wolf wrote in his memoirs that by the late 80s, we were in the enviable position of knowing that not a single CIA agent had worked in East Germany without having been turned into a double agent or working for us from the start. On our orders, they were all delivering carefully selected information and disinformation to the Americans. The supposedly meticulous Eastern European division, in fact, suffered one of the worst breaches of the entire Cold War.
It was a plea agreement that brought longtime CIA officer Rick Ames to court, charged with 9 years of spying, first for the Soviet Union, then Russia. During that time, he admitted in court, he identified virtually all Soviet agents working for the CIA and other American and allied security services. He put the KGB payoff at $2 million.
Aldrich Ames, one of the agency's most senior officers responsible for Soviet counterintelligence, turned out to be working for the Soviet Union. His betrayals led to the capture and execution of countless American spies in Russia. El Alpinista knew him. Everyone who was high up in the agency did. I did not have a high opinion of him, the mountain climber said, because I knew him to be a lazy drunkard. But he and his colleagues never suspected that Ames was a traitor. It was unthinkable to the old hands that one of our own could ever be beguiled by the other side the way Ames was, he said. We were all just taken aback that one of our own would betray us in that way. The mountain climber was one of the most talented people at one of the most sophisticated institutions in the world. Yet he'd been witness 3 times to humiliating betrayal, first by Fidel Castro, then by the East Germans, and then at CIA headquarters itself by a lazy drunk. If the CIA's best can be misled so completely, so many times, then what of the rest of us? Puzzle number 1. Why can't we tell when the stranger in front of us is lying to our face?